So, okay, so you don't go into bone marrow transplant, but to go back a little bit, what was it about what we would call today translational research that was grabbing your interest, as opposed to just straight clinical or straight science?
You know, during that time, I really thought that I can bring my two interests together.
Okay.
Look, the one thing was really I like to deal with kids. Mm-hmm. Kids like me.
Okay.
And on the other side, I have this upper strength, you know. Basic science strength.
And then just to clarify for me, because I have seen some of these theses that have been written for PhDs from MD programs, and how was it structured in Germany to get a PhD if you were in an MD in a medical school?
Okay.
How did you acquire a PhD?
Okay.
And what kind of work was involved?
Look, the thing is that for if you finish medical school in Germany, you are a physician afterwards. You are not an MD. To get the MD degree, you have to do something additional.
Okay.
And you can do that cheap. You simply can do some literature search, put that stuff together, make a review, that's it. And you get for this an MD.
Okay, and that was the thesis on interferon for you.
This was now.
Oh, no, okay.
The thing was that it was absolutely clear to me that I wanted to do experimental work.
Okay.
And so I started to do lab work. And I essentially spent then 6 years on that. Look, this this stuff then led to my stuff, which was then recognized as a PhD thesis.
And that was, the work that for your PhD thesis was the...
That was the interferon stuff.
Okay.
However, to be honest, what happened was that at the same time I did this stuff dealing with IBG, and this was way more important if looking back than this interferon work. Why did I start working with interferon? The thing was that at this hospital I was working at, during the time when I became fascinated with kids with cancer, they treated a child with interferon, and this child had cancer of the upper larynx. And the tumor went already to the brain, and it was totally resistant to chemotherapy, and this one child was cured with interferon. And this was one of the 2-3 chance events which came together in the late 70s, which led to this euphoria that interferon could be the new wonder drug.
Yeah.
And therefore, I wanted to go into this fantastic field.
Yeah.
And,
So it was like the work that was published in Cancer Research in 85 wasn't the work for your PhD.
No.
This was clinical work that really...
No. That was now the stuff I told you about. That was where I showed that IBG is actively transported into cells.
Yeah.
And then...
Right. At what point were you learning, like, the techniques, the biochemical techniques needed to complete the experiment?
Simply in this basic research lab, on the job.
Yeah, yeah.
That is one of my, of these typical things of my career, that whenever I needed to know a new methodology, I simply had to learn it. Yeah. And this went on in America for another 10 years, you know.
Your thesis work then on the kind of the hopes and optimism surrounding interferon was the basis of your PhD. And when you were deciding to go to the United States to do work in bone marrow, how was that, those ideas related? How was
okay.
your PhD work and then shifting to these ideas in
okay, when I originally planned to come here to the States, I did not plan to do a lot of basic research. I really planned to, sure, basic research would have been involved. The hope in the early 80s was to make bone marrow transplantation, to develop it to a treatment which could be done to all people, totally independent whether you have a compatible donor or not. And what happened was that at Sloan Kettering, as well as in Seattle, they developed the methods that not matched bone marrow can be used. And it looked good. And then why New York? Why not Seattle? This was due to my interest in music somewhere between jazz, rock, and punk, and that I was and that the cultural place was New York City.
Yeah.
During that time, nobody would have thought of Seattle, you know?
Yeah, well.
That was later.
I suppose you're right. You wouldn't want your hedge your bet, but that was...
Right. And so I came to New York.
Yeah. Well, where did this interest in music pop up?
Oh, I'm interested in music, really, between jazz, rock, and punk, avant-garde music, since I'm 14. And it started for sure with a very good education via public radio about jazz music, being interested in rock music, and so it developed, you know. And until today, really, it's one of my major interests.
And we're talking about you playing and composing music?
Not composing. That would be we tried to, when I was 16, we had for half a year a sort of early punk band. And thinking back what the ideas we had, yeah, but okay, that was amateurish, that was, it never led to anything. We made a lot of noise for half a year.
Okay. And so you saw New York as a good venue to experiment with some of your musical interests?
Oh,
play,
no, the thing is...
Listen.
More to listen. So. The thing is, look, I would love to do to actively make music, but I do not have the talents of some of the people. I tell you, there are good people out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you regret your decision not to go to Seattle in terms of
no,
the best music?
No, definitely not.
Really?
Because grunge developed
right.
in Seattle. Grunge, okay, I like Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
But look, for example, okay, let's stay in the rock scene. For me, Sonic Youth is still the better band.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And why come to the United States?
You know, essentially, two things. On one side, in a genuine interest in learning new techniques. On the other side, also at that time, all these people in pediatric oncology before me were before for 2 years in the States.
Okay.
So also as a vehicle to in in my career at the academic university setting where I planned to be, you know? Yeah.
Okay. And when you left Germany, what were you expecting in terms of, you know, returning?
I expected to be back after 2 years in Tübingen, and I expected to finish my residency and thought that then I would go for habilitation after, and then become an attending and for an academic career, yeah.
And how aware were you of kind of Tübingen's role and its kind of strengths in molecular biology?
Not.
You weren't.
But it's really interesting that Tübingen is has the Max Planck Institute with Dr. Nüslein Vollhardt. And she is the absolute pioneer in early development and in development of Drosophila and now zebrafish. And I was not aware of that. And it may be that in 85 I even would have told you that I'm not interested in that. Because what does that have to do with us humans, you know? During that time, it's really interesting that in the early 80s, in Tübingen, the breakthrough discoveries, which later led to the Nobel Prize of Nüslein Vollhardt, were done. I was totally unaware of that. I was aware at that time of basic research-wise of the early oncogene story, and I went to seminars at the Max Planck dealing with that stuff. But I had no idea that two buildings away, really groundbreaking work was done. Yeah.
So when you thought of doing bench work, it was purely kind of human tissue culture work?
I started to deal with tumor cells of the kids on the ward.
Yeah.
This is how it started.
Okay. Well, it seems to me, what happens to this work in bone marrow when you come to New York City? Because that's not what you end up working on. So
what happened?
Had you identified a lab that you wanted to work in at Sloan Kettering?
I wanted to go to the bone marrow transplantation unit and to the research they do in this context.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, two things happened. One thing is, which I'm pretty sure of, but which I did not really get in 85, when I started to work here, that this publication-wise, this new thoughts of pre-treating bone marrow, so that you bone marrow can be used against the MHC barrier. All these papers came out, but I think that the people at Sloan Kettering already knew that it's a total dead end. Because what's happening is, if you treat the bone marrow the way we hope to treat it, it's not rejected. However, essentially what you give to the recipients is acquired immunodeficiency. So you may cure sometimes the tumor, but the costs would be an AIDS-like syndrome. So it's useless. And what happened was that meeting with Richard O'Reilly, who was during that time the chief of the Bone Marrow Transplantation Service, and who was one, and still today is one of the big, big shots in bone marrow transplantation. He's now the chief of pediatrics at Sloan Kettering. We decided that I had money from the German Cancer Society for 2 years, and my English was not the best, that I first would spend a year in basic research, and then the second year I would do bone marrow transplantation. And, so the question was, what lab am I doing my basic research in? he said, I would have, with my background, I would have no difficulty finding labs. And so the question was, what would be an interesting lab? And I had this history with the IBG of imaging. This means that you look where tumors are. What we did is we added to IBG a radioactive element. Now, wherever this radioactive element was integrated, you could see it on a scanner. And he said, why don't you use this knowledge to develop imaging techniques with monoclonal antibodies? And so I went to a monoclonal antibody lab. During that time, monoclonals were still thought to be magic bullets. And the major problem during that day for monoclonals was the following, that there was a system how you reproducibly could make mouse monoclonal antibodies. But mouse monoclonal antibodies are of very limited use for a human treatment, because what's happening is you have a very specific antibody. You inject the antibody into a human being. It works beautifully. You can detect whatever you want to detect, or you can target a tumor. However, you inject it for the second time. What happened in between is that the human body recognizes it as mouse and makes now antibodies against mouse antibody, and so the antibody cannot work. So during that time, the big challenge was how to make human monoclonal antibodies. And it seemed that Ulrich Hämmerling, the person I did then my postdoc with, was on the way of developing a methodology of making human monoclonals. And this is where my postdoc here in the States started.
So it wasn't until you got here, actually arrived on the shores, that you realized that the bone marrow work may not pan out.
Oh, it still was thought. Oh, this specific methodology.
Right. Yeah.
No,
but you thought you would go back to it once.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I thought in the second year I would learn it. Because until I came here, I was convinced that this sort of bone marrow transplantation would be the future. And it only hit me then during my first year, talking with people doing it, that it looked very, very bleak. Yeah.
Well, and this we can talk about it in regards to this work that you do in Hämmerling's lab, but also your work with the IBG stuff. That what was the impetus driving you? Was it technical issues and to create better diagnostics for tumors, or was it therapeutic?
During that time, I still had this idea that my research should have something to do with clinics, should be translational. Okay. This idea vanished then years later, but.
Right. Well, we'll get to that then. Okay. So this original monoclonal idea with EBV transformed B lymphocytes doesn't exactly pan out as well as you thought. Is that right?
Okay. What the thing was,
that there was this autocrine.
Wait a sec. I have to explain that to you. So, we wanted to develop a methodology of making human monoclonal antibodies. And one possibility to get human monoclonal antibodies is by taking human B lymphocytes, infecting them with EBV, with Epstein-Barr virus, and you get immortalized cells. And this you can do. Let's assume that you would have a flu, and if we would take a week after all your symptoms are gone, your blood,
And if we would immortalize your B cells with Epstein-Barr virus, your B cells would grow, and we would find in the supernatant antibodies against flu. However, this would be a polyclonal mixture, that there we would at the same time immortalize hundreds of your cells. Now what's happening is, if 100 distinct clones are starting to grow, and if you do not clone them, if you do not grow them individually, only the one will overtake which is growing the fastest. And let's assume that, and so in 99% of all cases, when you would not do anything, you would lose your antibody of interest. And so what was totally clear in 85, 86, if this methodology would have any future, we would have to develop a method to clone the cells. Cloning means that you should be able to grow a single cell. And this is essentially how the whole my next 10 years of science started. Because Hamerling essentially told me, why don't you deal with the problem? Why are these cells, why are they growing perfectly fine if you, let's say, have 100,000 cells together in an ml of medium, but you go below 1,000 cells, nothing goes, they die. And this was the problem which I tried to tackle in 86.
Okay. Yeah. So that basic problem, hypothesis, paradigm has not changed.
Today it's different. But this was the starting hypothesis. And what happened was that the phenomenon is 100,000 cells per ml grow, 1,000 per ml do not. However, if you take the conditioned medium, the supernatant of the 100,000 cells, and give them to 1,000 cells, they will grow. So there seemed to be something in which enables, which the cells produce on which they are dependent. And so we thought that they produce an autocrine growth factor. And I tried to characterize this molecule. And what happened was that I did not have any experience with protein purification during that time. And our assumption was that this were the heydays of protein-derived, peptide-derived growth factors, that it also had to be protein growth factor. So I learned protein chemistry, protein purification. And I went in a second lab, which was led during that time by now a friend of mine called Carl Welte. He was also a Swabian who had his lab at Sloan Kettering. And so he taught me how to purify proteins. And in the beginning it looked good. However, whenever I went on sophisticated columns, I lost it. And for a year, I was unable to make any progress at all until some strange day. I do not know how I came to this idea. I came to Hamerling, and he told me afterwards that I thought I'm crazy, that I said, it's not a protein, it's a lipid. And I asked somebody else, how can you separate proteins and lipids, and we separated protein and lipid, and what happened was that the growth supporting activity was in the lipid fraction. And now that was it. I did not know how to deal with lipids. So I had to learn how to deal with lipids.
And how much convincing did it take for Hammerling to realize that, you know, it wasn't just protein, it was going to be a lipid?
I think the moment he saw the data.
Okay.
I think they were clean. And he admitted afterwards he never would have done this experiment. But he let me go because, look...
made you pursue this experiment?
Because otherwise I could have given up.
Right. But you don't. So why don't you give up and why do you...
But look, that is this typical thing that... or at least it's happening to me in my career every 1-2 years, at least once, that I hit a wall where I cannot explain my data at all. And then I'm one of these scientists who has these 3 o'clock in the morning cramps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where waking up at night and being afraid, also having sometimes crazy ideas. And this is the time when I leave bed and write my ideas down. And sometimes, 1 out of 10 times, they are good.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this was one of those times that
this was
said,
one of these
there, there is something there and it's worth pursuing.
No, definitely there was something. But my methods were... No, I simply needed a fundamental change in ideas. And the lipid idea was right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So I had to learn lipids. And how to... look, I could have had now given that stuff to a natural product lab, but then I would have lost it. But this was my project, so I had to learn it myself. And this is why I needed longer.
Okay.
Because, and then what happened was that there was this lipid activity. I tried to separate it at Sloan Kettering on an HPLC machine, test all the fractions. And then when I had a region where it seemed that I had activity, I was running over to Rockefeller University doing mass spectroscopy. And for, I think, a year, I only got chunk. And we were totally unable to make sense out of this mess of data which I generated. Because very likely it was never pure. And then what happened was that...
And why not think of it as just this was just a crazy idea and it wasn't going to work, rather than think, oh, this was impure, or this data is still us?
There was something.
Okay.
And what happened was that I could not do it. This activity, which was B cell produced, I was unable to characterize with the tools I had during that time. However, in... serum or in plasma, there was a substance which helped a little bit and which had seemed to be a little bit in this context of activity we were looking for. And so I decided, let's see what this substance is. Perhaps it could help us later to characterize the one which I was unable to get. And I purified this activity in serum and went to Rockefeller, and we did one trivial shot and we knew what it was, and I went home. I did not go back to Sloan Kettering and cried, because this was now 2.5 years of lipid work. And what did I do? I rediscovered vitamin A. The substance which was in serum was vitamin A. And vitamin A was for the first time described very early in the century. And it these German chemists already got the structure in the around 1915, and they already had it synthesized, and it's really not trivial, in the 20s, you know?
Right.
And I come now 60 years later, 70 years later, and rediscover.
Reinvent the wheel.
Right. And what came out of that was that then afterwards we were able to show that activated lymphocytes need vitamin A for survival. Okay.
Well, you've rediscovered vitamin A, but how trivial was it to discover that it's needed by bees?
Oh, this by itself was a nice publication. Nobody knew that before. Oh, and I did not know it when I was finding it out, that there, at the same time, when I found out that lymphocytes are dependent on vitamin A, so the immune system is dependent on vitamin A, a total different branch of scientists found exactly the same, but in a different context. What happened was that vitamin A was brought in this context of vision. And it's known since 3,000 years on papyruses. There is this information that if kids are night blind, see bad, they should eat liver. And liver is a beautiful source for vitamin A. And now vitamin A deficiency is still today the major reason for blindness in this world. And normally it starts, the first sign is night blindness. And so what the UNESCO did was it started programs in the developing world of trying to see whether you could give vitamin A to these kids. And they really did some nice epidemiological studies showing that you can prevent blindness, simply this sort of blindness, by giving vitamin A. And now some healthcare workers did really a good job. And this was that they found, they got this feeling that the kids which were on vitamin A supplementation were better off, and generally better off. And so in the mid-80s, some really beautiful studies were done where, for example, in southern India, villages were randomized. Half the villages got, the kids got vitamin A. The other villages, the kids did not get vitamin A. The kids were looked for every 6 weeks for nights of for signs of night blindness. If they would get night blindness, they would be supplemented with vitamin A. As long as it's night blindness, you can prevent the real blindness by giving vitamin A. And they simply followed up these kids, and what they found out was that the vitamin A supplemented group had the same morbidity for diseases. This means the same number of kids got sick. However, the mortality, that's the number of kids which died, was more than double in the group which was slightly vitamin A deficient. And this was prevent. So they brought vitamin A deficiency in a context with that you can deal with disease. Now, what does dealing with disease mean? This means that your immune system can handle this viral infection like measles. Mm-hmm. Or so at the same time, when I made the connection with vitamin A and lymphocytes, the epidemiologists made a connection of vitamin A with the immune system in general. Yeah. So that was the story.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you may think I'm comparing apples and oranges here, uh-huh. but I wanted to ask you, earlier you had committed yourself to this idea. You had this feeling that if you could get a group of people together, that you could make a difference using
right.
nonviolent organizational right. tactics to stop
right.
The nuclear weapon development in
right.
Germany. And yesterday you said, you know, it showed you that one human can make a difference.
Right.
Now here you're presented, you come to the United States, you make this commitment to come to the United States and learn techniques and to develop, you know, a project.
Right.
And it slowly gets transformed into something different.
Right.
And it ends up with you rediscovering vitamin A and going
right.
over to Sloan Kettering and crying. And so here is...
going home crying, not to Sloan Kettering.
Okay,
I was so ashamed,
crying.
You know.
Oh, okay.
I did not want to talk with anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how was your then kind of this optimism and your belief that as an individual you can make a difference being impacted by your progress or lack of progress in this now scientific endeavor?
You know, I do not see a big difference here. I think it's the same qualities which I think that starting with an optimism that you can change something or you can find something, there's no difference between my political background and the way I see research today. When I left, now you ask me, what are you doing politically today?
Well, no, I'm basically, you know, how are you interpreting this, what seems to be, you know, you saw as a major setback in your career by rediscovering vitamin A?
Oh, it was only a setback for a few days. It was not, imagine you spend 3 years in the hope to find something new and you rediscover the wheel.
Right.
Sure, I found a new quality of the wheel. I found then with work afterwards that, let's discuss about that, where the vitamin A work led.
Okay.
But no, I do not see it in retrospect. Oh,
so
by the way.
This kind of philosophy that you could make a difference as an individual if you set your mind on it, organized or, you know, created a set of experiments, whether it was organizing people for a political purpose or designing a set of experiments to prove a hypothesis, that you would make a difference.
That's the same.
Okay.
No. The following is, I'm really convinced, as long as you do it as a person, with your gut, it's fine.
Okay. So, and this vitamin A, these results was not telling your gut to drop the project.
Oh, no. Look.
Okay.
Then it started.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You know, what's really interesting is that I needed a relative long period, hands-on, to learn something like protein purification or to learn something like lipid purification. But I think career-wise, it helped me tremendously. It seemed to be a very non-productive time to spend 2 years to learn to deal with proteins. But look, then later as a side product, totally on the side, I was purifying the KIT ligand, proteins which I purified in the last years. You know, really, total new. The thing is, it took totally the fear from me of dealing with proteins, and today I'm totally convinced. If a protein can't be purified, I'm the person who can do it.
Okay.
I may be even a little bit arrogant, but this is my gut feeling here,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So the C-kit work, which we haven't really talked about,
right.
that was going on at the same time, and you were getting
results. What happened was that at the same time when I did the lipid work,
mm-hmm.
I did the C-kit work as the kit ligand work as a side project,
yeah.
and... Yeah. and be purified and be guarded.
You were getting validation.
Look, at least I could show that I'm able to purify a protein. Yeah.
So it wasn't all this despair.
No, no. Look, that's not my personality.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at what point did you think that you wouldn't have to extend your stay in the United States or extend your postdoc anymore?
That I would have to extend it, you mean, or would not?
No, I would not. Would or would not.
Okay.
How long did it take you to recover from this one setback?
Oh, don't see that as a setback.
Okay.
Essentially, what happened was that...
How long did it take you to stop crying that one evening after coming back? Let's put it down.
Perhaps 2 weeks.
Oh, okay.
No, what I mean with it was that the whole thing would... Luckily, shortly after, perhaps 1 or 2 months after. Look, I thought when I found vitamin A that I had totally screwed up.
Right.
And the reason for it was the following, that when I knew that it was a lipid, vitamin A is a lipid, I went to get reagents from different labs at Sloan Kettering, which were dealing with lipids. So I went to a steroid lab, got steroids. And I also went to a lab which was dealing with vitamin A. And I asked them to give me a substance to test. And I got from them retinoic acid. And according to the dogma at that time, retinoic acid is the mediator of a vitamin A's action outside of vision. And I had tested retinoic acid years before, and it did not have an effect. So my big disappointment was that I rediscovered vitamin A, and it seemed that I already had tested it years before, and it did not work. Now, the thing was, when I repeated then this experiment in the following weeks, that I compared vitamin A, the alcohol, with retinoic acid, the substance which I tested, it came out that my old data were valid, that retinoic acid was not able to keep immune cells alive. However, vitamin A was. And look, immediately it was clear that my work was not in vain.
Okay.
Essentially, this hard road of rediscovering vitamin A was needed to know that vitamin A is needed. Otherwise, everybody would have assumed it's retinoic acid.
Yeah.
Look, and if I would not have learned for 2 years to deal with lipids, I would have given up now. Because at this situation, I knew now, you give vitamin A to cells and they survive. So that's nice observation, fine, a paper, buy, and do the next, something else, you know. However, I already had spent 3 years on that stuff, and I immediately got this idea, it does not make sense that vitamin A itself is doing the function we are looking for. So the question was, is vitamin A made to a metabolite which is not retinoic acid, which can do the job? And yes, we found that if we give radioactive vitamin A to the cells, they produce a substance which is not retinoic acid and which can do this job, which was unknown. Mm-hmm. And now with my lipid background, I was able to characterize the substance. And this led to the discovery of the retroretinoids. And...
Okay.
Yeah.
And so then how did it feel to, after, you know, persevering with this problem, then to realize that you were the first one to discover the retroretinoids and this agonist?
Wait. I do not remember that too much. You want to ask me how it is when you find new things.
Thanks, yeah. Are there eureka moments?
hopefully it goes on like that once or twice a year.
Okay, I was just right, right. Look, about this update.
Because, for example, let's explain to you the last two ones I had, which I had during this year. Mm-hmm. Look, I was... the way I have my lab is that my grad students and techs and my postdocs are working on my major projects. And I myself, I want to work in the lab for at least half of my time with my own hands. So my people are doing the stuff which is which I have funding for, which are relative safe projects. And I myself have the luxury of playing around with a strange, with new ideas, you know? And this way, and we should discuss that again a little bit later, what led to a project where I was purifying a new enzyme called soluble adenylyl cyclase. And I spent 15 months on this project. We knew this activity was in one testis, was in testis, so I started to purify it from two testis, not from one. There are two in rats, so we start with two. And then with two, it was clear that the activity is there, so, but sure, it was not enough to characterize it. We went to 10, we went to 100, then finally with 950, we were able to do that stuff. But this needed now already 15 months. And then when we got sequence data and got the first... real now genetic information, really, it was a beautiful afternoon of high epinephrine and whatever you want, you know, because we found out two great things with the help of comparing what we got with known stuff. We found out that the first thing was I purified from the rat a substance which also exists in us humans. So, and the other thing was, and this was really a great, great, this of these events you really you live for, was that the substance which we purified was very similar to an enzyme which is found in archaeobacteria. And everybody thought originally that this enzyme, which is making this very important messenger molecule, cyclic AMP, was evolutionarily developed a few billion years ago and then went in the bacterial direction and in the known mammalian direction, and that it diverged. And we find now out